Welcome to Fate's Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast with Sam and Dennis. We are coming to you from our top secret headquarters at Project Quantum Leap, but you can find us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And please do us a favor by hitting the subscribe button on iTunes. All right, here we are on Fate's Wide Wheel. This week we will be discussing Star-Crossed, which was written by Deborah Pratt and directed by Mark Sobel. Its first broadcast date was Friday, March 31st, 1989. The leap date is June 15th, 1972, and Sam has leapt into college professor by the name of...
Dr. Gerald Bryant.
Thank you very much, yeah. Dennis.
What's the TV guide description, by the way?
The TV guide description reads, "As a professor, Sam meets a young woman who will break his heart in the future unless he can alter it." All right.
Here we go.
So there we are.
Yeah. So I call this episode, "Sam Beckett is the creepiest mayor of Creeptown who ever crept." And I'm talking about both the person he leaps into and himself. But we'll get into that.
You know, that has a little bit of merit. I won't deny it. As much as I like to hero worship our Dr. Beckett,
We talked about this during our preview episode. Like, this is one I hadn't, like, really gone back and critically watched in some time. And then, like, rewatching it for this, I was like, he does some problematic things in this episode.
Yeah, it's weird because the episode has, I've got fond memories of it, and it definitely has a special place in my heart, but watching it again was a little weird. Perhaps we should mention, by the way, that once again we are joined by our special guest, my wonderful wife, Jessica Conger. She is here with us at Project Quantum Leap and has seen the episode for the very first time, as she had never seen Quantum Leap up until about a week ago. So, Jessica... do you have any opening comments about the episode?
I was okay with this episode. I know you were trying to stick to episodes in order, but we watched a few other going past, which I did not like at all. So this one, this one ranked higher than those. So this one didn't bother me that much. Yeah. He was a bit creepy at times. And the... when he looked into the mirror and saw himself, I felt like they chose well with the actor.
It was
nice.
And that actor's name, by the way, who is that? I should pull up IMDb here on Ziggy. See what she says.
Yeah.
We'll
get into that. Yeah. So as you're pulling that up, so we start in the first scene. Sam, he leaps in. He is in a classroom. He's standing in front of a chalkboard, which has the word obsession written on it. And he spins around, and there's a classroom of adoring college women, college students.
Yeah.
Has a pipe in his mouth, which promptly falls out of his mouth as he turns around in shock. And then we get into the events of the episode. And every single woman in that scene is just, like, having sex with him with their eyes.
They are smitten. It's reminiscent of Indiana Jones, where he's teaching the class and all of the female students are... fawning over him.
Yes, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, I'm late to the party on the Indiana Jones movies, but
really,
back like right before Trump's inauguration, we watched one of them. It was almost like getting prepared to fight Nazis because we knew what was coming.
Well,
yes, I saw the scene that you're talking about. I was like, oh, that's where.
Yeah, that's
very reminiscent of
Star-Crossed. It does remind me of it. It's it's also, I think, interesting because considering that this is the very next leap. After the pilot episode, that we kind of got the information in the baseball leap, which is the second leap of the pilot, that he holds 6 doctorates.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's kind of funny that now all of a sudden here we are seeing him as a professor, clearly mm-hmm. an intelligent, educated person. Mm-hmm. John Talo, by the way, is the name of the actor who plays the mirror image of Dr. Gerald Bryant.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's funny. Like, yeah, he has 6 doctorates, but he has no love for English literature.
Yeah,
which makes my least favorite cliches bell bottoms, something, 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 and English lit. You can hear the disdain in his voice in there.
Oh, yeah.
So they start talking about one of the stories that I can't remember.
Wuthering Heights?
Wuthering Heights,
that's
yes.
Right. Thank
that
you,
is
Jessica.
It. And before he can get too sucked into having to discuss it, he is saved by the bell.
Yeah,
ring,
indeed.
Ring. And then we find out that they are in summer school because there's no class on Fridays in summer school that somebody mentioned. And of course, as all the women file out of the room, they continue to have sex with their eyes with Sam / Dr. Gerald Ryan.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's an interesting little scene. You know, it sets things up well. I feel like, you know, they are able to establish very early on that he's a fish out of water. And it's something that they'll continue to do well, that they did well in the pilot. That initial moment of being thrust into this new situation and having to figure out what the hell's going on. And I think that one of the great things about the show that we'll continue to see, but we've already seen just within the pilot and this episode, is that it can be played in a comedic way, you know, can have fun with it, but there are also going to be other times when it's not so funny.
For sure.
So, you know, obviously I think this is one of those that results in some humor. And then class is out.
So he gets out in the courtyard, he pulls out his wallet, he sees Dr. Gerald Bryant's driver's license, so he gets a basic idea. And that's when we meet Jamie Lee. Other than outside, she was one of the students in the classroom, but now they run into each other. They bump into each other, knock off books. He's able to conveniently get her name because she has her name written all over her textbooks.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you, God, time or fate or whatever, for handing that.
Yeah.
That little thing over.
Yeah, and Jamie Lee is an interesting character, as played by Leslie Sachs. I think I'm going to hold off talking too much about the character specifically until we get to some later scenes that tell us some more, but it's clear from that very first scene that, you know, she is definitely going to be integral to the plot.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's clear that they have a relationship, and it's all been implied that it is a sexual relationship.
Right.
Because, it's the classic old line that I felt like me and my teenage buddies used a lot of. Because he's like, you're a student, no fraternizing. That's not what you said last night.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, oh, okay, so it's clear, like, what the relationship is, and then he sees Donna.
Yes.
Which we haven't seen. Yeah, well, like, in the voiceover right then, he says, oh, it's Donna. Yeah, of course, this is Lawrence. And
So
he sees her walking into the Wrath Skeller.
Yep.
And we find out through their dialogue and Jamie Lee's dialogue that she is going to work there.
Yeah.
But the Wrath Skeller is not open yet, so Sam cannot go in yet. So now we find ourselves back at Dr. Gerald Bryant's house.
Yes. Yes, which is where we start to get a clear picture painted of a man who is you know, a bit of a drunk.
Absolutely. I've always found it difficult, like, to understand this episode or understand, like, what women's appeal is. I mean, obviously they're sleeping with him for their grade, but he looks in the mirror and he's just a mess.
So,
and it's like, how good does this guy have to be in bed that they look past?
Oh, he's probably trash, but I think it was... They did cast him very well because he did look rather worse for the wear, but he had very piercing eyes. I think they were, like, very blue. So I feel like he's teaching all these romance novels in school and, you know, he's older. And so I could see how... Maybe not all the girls in the class was a bit of an exaggeration. I could see how when you have sort of this role model or someone you're looking up to who seems very intelligent and is talking about all these very romantic... He probably brings up all these very romantic ideas that sort of implies that he feels the same way. And so you could look beyond maybe his sort of disheveledness and kind of... Maybe once he was very handsome and just look at the piercing eyes and...
Well, and not only that, I think... I mean, it's a cliche, but I also think that there's probably that... that idea that here's this guy who's fallen off the rails a little bit, you know, he looks a little rough around the edges, but I can be the one that softens that out, that smooths that out. That, that underneath, you know, the musk of booze and, you know, pipe smoke, that there's a diamond under there, you know, that there's somebody that, that can be rescued and fixed, and that, you know, the students want to be the one that, that does that. And I think that clearly there's the power dynamic of teacher and student. And
for sure.
So, it does make sense. To be completely honest, I've seen that. You know what I mean? I've literally seen almost exactly that with a little bit less 5 o'clock shadow, maybe. But,
yeah.
You know.
It's interesting, like seeing the first mirror shot throughout the entire series. It's interesting when the producers choose when to have Sam's hairstyle match the mirror image.
Yeah.
And when it does not.
Yeah.
And his hair is all over the place in the mirror. And
right.
Obviously, like, Sam's hair is very neat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and the idea, too, that, not to skip ahead, but the idea that Sam ends up cleaning up as Dr. Bryant.
Sure.
You know, he does end up shaving, he ends up combing his hair and that sort of stuff. And yet, yeah, you know, Sam doesn't have the growth on his face and doesn't have the, you know, the disheveled hair. And so it is interesting to see that particular aspect as well. And it's something that, honestly, I feel like we get, there are a couple of things that we're going to talk about in the next few episodes of the podcast as far as Mirror Image and Sam that I think are very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But this is certainly a start to that, without a doubt. So Jamie Lee obviously wants something to happen, you know, right here, right now.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam has to kind of like shoo her away, get her out.
For sure. I mean, this is where she reveals that she has revealed the entire nature of her relationship to her dad.
Yeah.
And this is the first scene where Al shows up and reveals somewhat, this is what Sam is here to do, that in the original history, Gerald Bryant and Jamie Lee were forced into, how does Al put it? A nice, intimate shotgun wedding, 12 gauge, I think.
Yeah.
And he's there to prevent that.
Stop them
from happening.
Ruining their lives.
And thus ruining their lives.
Yeah, and you know, I was going to save this for a little bit later, but I'm going to go ahead and talk about it right now. I think that one of the interesting things about this particular episode, as we'll see through the whole thing, that is sort of typified by Leslie Sachs, is the acting in the episode, to me, is all over the place.
It is very, I don't want to say stylized, but it is very geared towards comedy and not taking it.
Oh yeah, she's way over the top.
Yeah,
but I feel like almost everybody in this episode is way over the top. So
yeah, you know,
and her boyfriend.
But the thing is that those two characters absolutely are, and I think that, you know, Sam, just because of Scott Bakula in general, you know, he does kind of tread the line. I think Al kind of treads that line as well. But then I would say like Donna. And some other characters that I won't, you know, for spoiler's sake, since we want to maintain some continuity here, yeah, are a little bit more grounded. But yeah, so she's pretty over the top in this scene, and I think has some moments where if you're not prepared for the comedic aspects of the show, could start to be a little eye-rolling.
Mm-hmm.
For me, you know, rewatching the episode, there was a certain element of just like, all right, when does she go away? And I feel bad saying that because I don't think that there's anything necessarily wrong with her performance.
Mm-hmm.
But perhaps maybe the decisions that were made behind the scenes to go in that direction.
For sure.
As opposed to maybe keeping things just a little bit more grounded. And I'm not saying that the situation didn't dictate a certain amount of, you know, over the top passion, if you will.
Well, it's interesting, like, if you just listen to the dialogue of that scene, it's weird because Al shows up and Romeo and Juliet is mentioned, and Al mentions that Romeo committed suicide, and, you know, in one of those, like, three-way conversations, Sam blurts out, suicide, and she's like, oh, yes, of course, I love Pac. Like, she's ready to commit suicide over this. It's like, if you didn't play it for laughs, this could be a very dark scene.
That's true. That's very true. Well, it would be fascinating to me, and I'm sure it's out there, so maybe, you know, we'll eventually come back to this or insert it into something later, but I've not, unfortunately, read much about what Deborah Pratt has to say about this, considering that this was, like, her first script for the show. Mm-hmm. It'd be very interesting to hear her take on the direction of the episode, and if it was what she had in mind when she was writing it. And I imagine that it's entirely possible that she did, mm-hmm. you know, because I think she was clearly aware that, the show was supposed to have these comedic elements. Mm-hmm. Like you were saying on the last episode, Belisario had kind of almost thought of the show as this, you know, science fiction comedy.
Or dramedy, maybe,
mm-hmm. as opposed to what it evolves into. Sure. So that's something I wanted to throw out there about Jamie Lee and dear Leslie Sachs, because it is interesting to see, especially when you compare it to what we got in the pilot episode. Mm-hmm. It does seem very, very different in nature and tone.
So we move on. He gets her away, basically tells her to come back when the moon has crest over the towers of Camelot. And he's just setting himself up for failure later on.
Yeah.
One
quick thing. We did get an oh boy moment in this scene when Jamie Lee's coming on to him.
Yes.
In one of
early on in the choreo, like, oh boy.
Yeah.
I still haven't noticed those.
Well,
oh boys.
They're not as prominent yet.
He's subtle.
Yeah.
Later on in the series, where they come much more of the trademark thing that
I need to remember to, like, listen for.
Much more of the trademark thing that they are. But then after she leaves, Sam reveals to Al that Donna Alesi is here. And we don't know who Donna is, but it is very clear that they both know who Donna is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Sam is ready to go. Like, I don't care what Ziggy says I'm here to do. I am here to save my future relationship with Donna. And then I do believe this is where we go to a commercial break, and then we come back.
But go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I'm saying then when we come back, we're back out in the courtyard of Lawrence College, and this is when we come into the conversation of Al explaining to Sam, like, the rules of Quantum Leap Theater,
yes.
your rules, the time traveler cannot use time travel to benefit or change their own life.
Yeah, and it's interesting because just knowing what we know about production blocks, that this episode was actually filmed later in the production blocks, but they decided to air it earlier. This episode aired out of order. It was mm-hmm. originally the next episode after the pilot was supposed to be one we'll talk about later, mm-hmm. And this was supposed to be like the third episode. And so it's interesting that we come up against something like that so early, and I think it's one of the things that Deborah Pratt herself has said in retrospect, that she's not entirely sure that having the drama of that happen immediately after the pilot, you know, made a lot of sense. But I also think that the episode as a whole does some wonderful things to represent the series, maybe better than some of the episodes that are about to come. So I knowing that, it's interesting that this discussion about the rules and Sam's decision to break the rules right away happens so early, and yet because of the way the episode, I think, fits together on the whole, it does almost make more sense to have it where it's placed.
Mm-hmm. I have a question about the rules. So they've made this rule you can't affect your own time stream or your own future, but I'm assuming they did not know going into this before he leaped that the whole thing would be you have to go back to change something before you can move on. They just assumed he could go observe and then go home. Mm-hmm. Right. So would they, would
at this
the
point
rule,
they've made it clear, but yeah, that's a good guess.
Yeah,
I'm assuming then the rule would be like you shouldn't make any changes at all. I mean, that's kind of generally time travel. That's typically, I feel like, often mm-hmm. the rule is you're trying not to change anything, or anything that has already happened has happened. And, you know, even if you are thinking you're changing something, it's still going to cause the future to happen this way it already laid out. So it's interesting that, I don't know what my question is exactly, but the fact that...
It's like they don't have the rules clearly established
for the show itself.
Yeah, like we talked about, like, last week on the pilot. It seemed like from episode to episode, they kind of changed the rules to what was most beneficial for that particular episode. So I think the practical answer is that just for the drama of this particular episode,
heightens the stakes to say you can't be doing this.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, again, based on what you were just saying too, the idea that in most time travel fiction, there is that aspect of you can't change or affect your own past, that is a part of it, or you can't change the past at all in some cases. So I think that as far as rules go, it feels fairly standard. The thing that's interesting to me about it, and something that we've already talked a little bit about behind the scenes and will certainly continue to talk about as the show evolves, is that at this particular point, we don't necessarily know the impetus for the project. Mm-hmm. I would argue that perhaps we never learned that, but maybe we do. We'll talk about that more as we go on.
Sure.
And so based off of that, I think it also makes the rules much more fascinating at this early stage in the game, because do the rules provide us with any clues as to why Sam wanted to do this? If a rule that he set up himself, as Al tells us, is you can't change your own past, why does he want to do this? Is it just because we can? Is it that idea of why put a man on the moon? Because it's what's next. Do we travel through time because it's something we just got to do? Why is he doing this? And if not to change the past, to change his own past, what was the impetus for it?
Well, especially when, I think this is the episode where they talk about that, you can only travel amongst your own time stream.
Mm-hmm.
And so
it's reinforced in this episode.
So it's interesting to have that rule, you're only traveling within your lifespan, basically.
Yeah.
But you're not allowed to do anything amongst yourself. But here you are stuck in a place where all you can do is try to change the future for the better. And so why wouldn't you want to, at least, I guess?
Sure. And compound that with the fact that of all of the places that he could leap to and all of the times that he could leap to, he leaps into a time and place where he is indeed at arm's reach from the woman that we find out in this very scene left him at the altar.
Mm-hmm.
So to kind of springboard off of this particular scene discussing the rules, they're talking about the relationship that Sam had with Donna. He remembers bits and pieces of it. He knows that they were together. He knows that they were supposed to be together. He kind of remembers when they met. Al fills in the gaps. He knows that the wedding never happened. Al ends up telling him that it was because she didn't show up.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this particular moment where Al has informed him that the wedding never took place because she didn't show up, obviously, yeah, Sam wants to do something to change that,
mm-hmm.
to give them a second chance. And so we get the rules. And I think that it is interesting, all of these things that we're talking about as far as the rules, why he did this, what the game is, that out of all of the places and times that he could go, this is where he ends up.
To jump back to when they're talking in the courtyard before we learn what Sam and Donna's relationship was, I think it's really interesting. Al introduces the committee
mm-hmm.
in the future.
Whitesburg, I wrote that down.
And in the early episodes, they had this running joke of Al would throw out a name and Sam would go, short guy in knickers. No, tall, skinny guy with stovepipe hat.
Yeah.
Sam always got the exact opposite of what it was. And I love like the interviews, Weitzman's the head of the committee, and already they want you
to declare...
There's
issues.
Yeah, they want you to declare non compos mentis, mentally insane. They want to pull you basically out of leadership of the project.
Well, and I think, one of the things that I will say right off the bat, that there were some bullet points that I kind of highlighted, as we're watching the episode, and two of the big ones that really stuck with me through this episode are the rules and the committee. And I think that to establish some of this stuff, the way that they're doing it, was very smart. I think it kind of heightens the tension, but it does it in a way... this episode's more overt about it because it's introducing some of these concepts, obviously. But I think that they do it in such a way that it doesn't necessarily feel like it distracts from the objective of the leap. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because we're learning about the rules, we're learning about the committee, but I don't feel that that's taking anything away from the drama of Dr. Gerald Bryant and what's happening around Sam in that timeline,
mm-hmm.
which I think is kind of interesting. And it shows, maturity on the screenwriter's part to be able to kind of have these added elements and these subplots without things getting overblown,
mm-hmm.
Which we will definitely talk more about on our next episode.
For sure. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
So I think that, I think that setting that up is great. And, that we also, that with Weitzman in particular, we get this, identifiable character who is kind of,
he's an antagonist.
He is an antagonist.
Like a nemesis to Sam and Al.
That's, I was going to use that word, but I almost felt uncomfortable using it because I don't want it to feel like, he's like this big bad that's off screen that we never
for
see,
sure.
Especially considering the way modern television works. When we introduce a character like that, he would
mm-hmm.
be, the quote unquote, to use the Joss Whedon phrase, the big bad.
For sure.
And I don't want to, bluff our way into saying that this
sure.
is who he is, but
it kind of going on a tangent. Do you ever watch the Bozo Show as a kid?
Totally.
Do you remember ever seeing The Boss? this is where our age difference may come in. I bet you never, I bet you watching the show never saw the boss. I bet you only saw the interactions when they talked to him on the phone.
You know, I think you're probably right.
And here is why. Because the actor who played the boss passed away from a stroke.
Oh.
This was something that the kids watching the Bozo show were never supposed to know.
Sure.
But since I went to kindergarten in the afternoons, I heard about this because one morning the Bozo show aired. I kept playing, watching TV while my mom cleaned the house, and then they came on with a special announcement on WGN saying that the actor who played the boss had passed away.
Wow.
And then I went to kindergarten in the afternoon. I remember, like, I was so upset by this. Like, that was the first thing I told Mrs. Brazier when I walked into to kindergarten that morning. But from then on, at the Bozo show, you never saw the boss. You only saw him on the phone. For some reason, they decided to not replace him. So I was like the kid who know a little bit more. It's like, they say he's on the phone on the other end. But no, he's really dead.
Yeah.
And that's why. So anyway, that's what made, like, Weitzman is like this unseen nemesis that you never see.
Well, and that's another thing, and this will become even more overt in this episode. We'll talk about it here in a few minutes, I imagine. But it is interesting to think that, again, the only characters that we see that are from the proper future, if you will, are Sam and Al. And Sam is clearly displaced. And so Al is really the only connection we have. And everyone else is invisible, whether literally, as we'll see later in this episode, or metaphorically. And so I think that it's done well. It introduces this extra aspect of the plot that, for modern television viewers in particular, I think is interesting, because now all of a sudden we have something that's part of the arc, if you will.
Sure.
You know, like, this is something that we can imagine is always there. Even if it's not necessarily mentioned in each episode, it's there. Mm-hmm. It's present. Present. You know, Weitzman, the committee, there's something else out there.
There. So we have this conversation. We have a nice little special effects moment where Al is illuminated by the black lights in the Wrath Skeller, so he's a little bit see-through. So we have a nice little hologram moment there.
And we get Inagata De Vita by Iron Butterfly playing.
That's awesome.
Helps to set that tone, I think.
For sure. And what I love, I don't know why I love this, but when Sam is misremembering what happened between him and Donna, at first he misremembers this and says, "I didn't show up."
Mm-hmm. Right.
And Al has to correct him.
Yeah.
And I just find, I don't know why, I just find that like a really nice touch.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so we get into the scene and he meets Donna, he sits down, orders a cheeseburger, and she finishes it. She knows how Sam likes his cheeseburger.
Well, and two quick things that I want to interject there is, one, we get this idea, which I don't necessarily know has been as explicit, is how selfish Sam can be. You know, we get a little bit of it in the pilot episode,
mm-hmm.
because there, you know, he wants to get home, he wants to make that phone call to his dad, he wants, you know, he's trying to do these things,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't seem it's quite as self-serving, and as altruistic as Sam can be,
mm-hmm.
you know, as I mentioned for the pilot episode, I think if he couldn't get away, he would stay in, you know, 1950s as Tom Stratton and live out that life if he had to.
Mm-hmm.
But in this episode, it is very much, I want.
Yes. And I would argue, not just for Sam, like anybody, the more altruistic someone is, when they snap back hard the other way, they can be
totally
incredibly selfish and self-centered.
Yeah.
So, yes.
And then the other thing that I wanted to mention is about, like, fate. You know, out of all the times and places he ends up, this is where he is. And when she shoots that cheeseburger order back at him, you know, to him, that's fate ringing a bell.
Absolutely.
You know, it's just like, she knows.
Right there. And it was noted in one of the books that we like to reference that in the original draft script, I'm not sure how it's done, but they explicitly state that Donna knows Sam's cheeseburger preference because they are star-crossed.
Yeah.
And that they are joined by fate, where it's a little bit more vague as it's presented.
So it wasn't that the professor just happened to have the same cheeseburger order?
Ooh, boom! That's a nice...
kind of what I assumed.
No, and that's great.
Well, it's like the eye contact that they share in that scene. Like,
yeah, because he was being creepy, and she was like, I assume he comes in there. She knew him, clearly. Mm-hmm. I couldn't tell. I can't remember. Did she take his class? I know she says something about, like, I don't have to sleep with you to get good grades.
It was implied that, yes, she is in one of his classes.
She knows him. And so I feel like he's being different than he has been in the past. And so I think she does the order. And he's like, my order, she knows. And she's like, what the hell is wrong with this guy? Yeah. Like,
I don't know. I felt like in the scene, like, she had some eye contact with him, that there was clearly something
different.
We should mention by this point, if you haven't watched this episode, Donna is played by
Terry Hatcher. Yeah, a 25-year-old Terry Hatcher.
Yes, who goes on, you know, to, I think her next big thing after this was Lois and Clark, The Adventures of Superman, which is probably my favorite Superman incarnation, but that's a whole other conversation. And then later on, Desperate Housewives, and then in between Lois and Clark and Desperate Housewives, there were the Radio Shack commercials. But anyway, so yeah, Terry Hatcher is Donna.
Should we take a quick moment, because we talked about Leslie Sachs a little bit, to maybe talk about Terry Hatcher as an actor in this particular episode?
For sure.
So I don't want to give my opinion first. What did you guys think?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I have a commentary on her as an actor. I have commentary on how the character is written, but I think she carried out the role as best as it was written.
I don't have any thoughts. I honestly can't really remember. It didn't stick out to me as not sufficient. It was clearly not as over the top as the Southern girl.
She was much more grounded. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So anyways, for me, I think it's interesting because I have very distinct memories of the first few times that I saw this episode. I saw it when it originally aired, and then I think the next time I saw it would probably be like 1994, so about 5 years afterwards.
Sure.
And for me, I can just remember as a boy being smitten with her, first of all.
Oh, absolutely.
And also just really buying into the star-crossed nature of Sam and Donna's relationship. I think I was kind of always attracted to stories like that. You know, they're just the romantic in me. There was something about that I, you know, their love will overcome all or whatever. So watching it now, after having not seen it for probably 10 plus years, it's interesting because there's a part of me that watching her, I guess I had a bit of a hard time buying her as the person that Sam Beckett falls in love with, as this brilliant physicist and mathematician. And that might sound unfair.
We'll get to it later on in the montage that I call Sam mansplains quantum physics to the quantum physics students. But I think that's how the character was written. It was nothing at the fault of Terry Hatcher.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I'm certainly not trying to say that she was anywhere nearly as bad as, like, say, Denise Richards in The World Is Not Enough, you know, the James Bond movie where she's supposed to be this brilliant physicist and, you know, and all this, and it was hard to buy. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. When it comes to Donna Alisi and Terry Hatcher, I'm not saying that there's not the opportunity and eventuality that Sam would fall in love with this woman. Clearly we're seeing her as a young college student. But there were, I guess, just my gut reaction after having seen the episode multiple times and now thinking about it again, after having been smitten with her and buying into it completely and all the romantic notions that go along with it, mm-hmm. that watching it now in my 30s, I'm looking at it and I'm just sort of like, really, is that her? Is that actually her? Regardless,
well,
I mean...
Well, to throw this out there, what age was Jessica when you two met?
24.
Is that right?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Yes,
yeah.
It is.
Actually,
she was 23. She was 23 when we first met.
I mean, so let's say, you know, whatever plot device time travels you back to a point where you meet her as another person.
Sure.
And she's 16 years old.
Yeah.
Is she the person that you would have fallen in love with when you met at 23?
Well, first of all, that's a little icky to think about.
Okay, yeah.
But no, in all seriousness, that is a very, very good point. And I think, yeah, that it would be interesting.
Because she's just starting her education as well.
Yeah, and it's, well,
she's clearly interested in, because he talks about, don't they talk about both being interested in time travel? Because
oh,
she's clearly already
right.
Well,
down, she's going
well,
down
I mean,
the track.
I mean,
yeah.
they establish in a voiceover that Sam was doing what they had both had dreamed of, mm-hmm. that he was traveling through time.
Because they met, and I don't know if this is explicitly said, but I know that it's pretty much established as, you know, canon, if you will. It's in my head canon. They pretty much met working on Project Starbright.
She was just leaving the Starbright
yeah.
project, which, as a nerdery aside,
yeah.
says the guy who co-hosts a Quantum Leap podcast. In the novels, it's established that Project Starbright was actually centered around deep space travel.
Yes.
But by the end of Starbright, they realized they didn't have the information that they needed for Starbright. And so Project Quantum Leap was supposed to be a step back in a way to learn the information that they needed
yeah.
for deep space travel. Which, by the way, in this episode and the previous episode, we see Al wearing the star.
Yes.
Insignia, which they never explain.
No.
Just for the fact that it is a bright star.
Right.
I've always assumed that that was a leftover from
Project Starbright.
From Al's time working on Project Starbright, and he just, like, yeah. wears that for nostalgia.
Yeah, you know what, and I hesitate to do this, and who knows, maybe we'll even cut this out, and it won't even air in this episode, and we'll save it for later, but to delve deeper into that, I think that one of the things that is very fascinating to me about the mythology that does get added in and sprinkled in over 5 seasons of episodes is that we know Project Starbright was something that Sam worked on, that Al worked on, that Donna worked on, that Al was a drunk and in a deep dark hole the entire time they worked on it, that Donna ends up leaving Sam at the altar and, you know, and is never heard from again in the context of this, and that Sam is also in probably a pretty interesting place because of a couple of events that happened in his life, which I won't spoil in case we do use this, that there were 2 things in particular that happened to him within the last 10 or 15 years that bring him to this point, and that out of this project is born Project Quantum Leap, which I think can maybe inform, or we can infer, informs a little of maybe the reasons why he did decide to go forward with this time travel idea.
Absolutely.
Maybe not,
mm-hmm.
but yeah.
But to jump back, like, the question I asked about, like, you know, had you gone back and met Jessica at an early age, like, watching this episode, you know, it put me in mind of me and Betsy's relationship. Betsy, my wife, for you listeners at home. Betsy moved to Chicago in 2000, 2001. I moved to Chicago in 2006. So there were 5 years we were in the city together, because we didn't meet until 2011. There were 5 years that we were in the city together where we didn't know each other. But then after we met and started dating, we found out that we were in very close proximity to each other during that time. Like, almost at a creepy How I Met Your Mother level. We lived in adjacent neighborhoods. We shared the same grocery store for a while. And I won't go into the long, convoluted way how we figured this out, but in 2007, she went to a party in this guy's basement apartment in Roscoe Village, 3 o'clock in the morning. The guy was cranking his music. Cranking it so loud, in fact, that the upstairs neighbor came downstairs and pounded on the door, yelling at this guy to turn down his GD music. And 7 years later, in 2014, after we'd been together for 3 years, we discovered that I was that neighbor who came downstairs
wow.
and pounded on the door.
Crazy.
But we've talked about this a lot because of stuff that we had going on between 2006 and 2011. Had we met anywhere during that time, had we met any time before the time that we met and started dating a few weeks later, we probably would not have connected.
Yeah.
It is very likely we may have walked away from each other, like, not even liking each other.
Sure.
Just because of the different baggage, the different things that we had going on during that time.
Yeah.
So I find it interesting within the context of this episode. First off, like what you were saying, like, Donna doesn't strike you as the kind of woman that Sam would fall in love with. But also, Sam is trying to force a relationship that where they don't meet for another 12 years.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. I don't remember there being a sense of, like, the two of them having really that intensive moments, or like him trying to almost establish something with her in the past. Like, it felt more like he knew who she was going to be and he was doing all this for that person versus like you right here now.
I don't think he was trying, like, obviously not trying to establish a romantic relationship being
in
the life of Bryant, but he was trying to forge an emotional connection right off the bat that wasn't that wasn't merited.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, one of the things that the episode does touch on and hints at is that as we go on, there seem to be these moments where Donna is starting to see Dr. Bryant in a different light. Mm-hmm. But I think that Sam is smart enough, aware enough to resist any sort of urge to be with her as Dr. Bryant, mm-hmm. knowing what that might cause.
That would have been a creepy scene.
Yeah.
But it just felt like just him forcing the issue. Like, by the end of the scene with the cheeseburger, as she walks away, she very clearly says, please don't talk to me again.
Right.
And the next time, one of the next scenes to jump ahead, he just strolls into the science building, just completely ignoring the fact that the last time they spoke, she directly said, please don't speak with me again. And it kind of, the reason why I found it problematic, it kind of plays into the trope that's sprinkled through a lot of romance fiction, is that if a guy likes a girl, if he really likes her, sometimes all it takes is just being persistent and really just sticking with it until he wears her down, until she realizes that they're right. And there are still problematic things now. I saw an article, a friend of mine shared it in my Facebook newsfeed a few days ago. It was a think piece talking about the underlying misogyny of the Big Bang Theory.
Hmm.
And either you watch that show?
I've seen a few seasons.
I can't stand it.
Okay. I can't. I've only watched like a few minutes of it here and there. But the article was talking about how, like, on that show, like, the male characters on that show, like, they, I don't know if it's one or all of them, like, they all have this bad habit of, like, being persistent with women and being pushy. And it's like misogyny wrapped up in all this cute nerdery.
Right, because it has a happy ending, so it's okay.
Right.
Versus if you're actually being harassed by somebody who's, you want to leave you alone.
For sure.
And I will argue, you know, to my last breath, that there is a time and a place for persistence, but you have to absolutely be aware. If a woman says, please don't talk to me again, that's not the time for it. If a woman continues to talk to you but declines the offer to go out on a date with you and you decide to persist in trying to get that date, I think that's okay. And the reason why I think that's okay is because I wouldn't be sitting here with my wife right now if that were not the case.
Ooh, okay.
So I think what Sam does in this episode is absolutely problematic.
Yeah. Yeah, hold on, yeah. Jump ahead to, like, what he ends up doing, like, later on.
Yeah, right.
To get us back on track with the thing. So, Donna tells him to leave him alone, and she ends up, like, you find out that she has left her shift because she wasn't feeling well, but during this, we meet Oscar.
Oscar. Michael McGrady.
Yes, who was actually, he was name-checked earlier in the episode by Jamie Lee.
Right.
Oscar's a Neanderthal who goes to some other neighboring university, I can't remember now.
Oh,
he wants to pin me, because he's a wrestler.
Right, he's a wrestler, yeah.
And so this is where we get Oscar, who approaches like, hey, I told you not to talk to my girl. And Sam's like, Donna's your girl? Like, Jamie Lee is my girl.
Yeah.
And then we get into this, one of the more comedic scenes of the episode.
You know, and well played, I will say, even though I'm not necessarily a huge fan of some of the comedic things that happen in this episode, and by saying not a huge fan, that doesn't mean that I don't like it, I just, you know, don't like it as much as I like some of the other stuff in the episode. Mm-hmm. But this scene, I think, works really well, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that most of it's focused on Sam. Even though, you know, and Michael just ends up, or Michael, Oscar, mm-hmm. who's played by Michael McGrady, ends up being this, you know, imposing presence that Sam, Scott Bakula, gets to just play off of.
For sure.
And it works really, really well. Mm-hmm. Because he, you know, he starts saying, like, oh, no, Jamie Lee's just doing this to make you jealous, and, you know, don't worry about anything. Mm-hmm. And
it's totally, yeah, like, read her poetry.
Yeah.
And he starts off, I can't remember what the limerick is.
Oh, God.
It's not there once was a man from Nantucket, but there's
but
something.
But it's along the lines
there's
of that,
something
yeah.
on par with that, where he starts saying, and Sam's like, no, like read her like genuine poetry.
Okay.
It's also, it should be noted, and this is problematic with all of the college students in this episode, is they are clearly way too old for college. Especially this actor who plays Oscar. Like, my first impression rewatching this episode was like, this was like if Will Ferrell played a college student. And watching this episode with Betsy, like, every time he appeared, like, Betsy was like, oh, the 30-year-old college student. The next time, oh, the 35-year-old college student. The next time, oh, the 45-year-old college student. Here we go. But anyway, but this scene, the plot is, the story is furthered by Sam encouraging Oscar to, like, horny is not romantic to a girl. Like, right. You need to, like, read her poetry. Like, you need to romance Jamie Lee if you want to be with her. And he throws out, like, I'm going to try it. I love her so much. I'll try anything. But I think you're feeding me a load of crap.
And if it doesn't work,
I will be back. I will be back to break your face.
Break your face. That's right. Which brings us to the next scene. Mm-hmm. And who should show up yet again for Dr. Bryant's house is Jamie Lee.
So that's nice. So this is an interesting... the scene starts off with Sam in his robe and he's smoking a pipe. And this is a product, I think, of just like early on in the series and not really knowing who Sam was. But to give a minor spoiler away, later on in the series, we find that Sam is very anti-smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And he's smoking a pipe in this scene. And practically, it's just because this early on in the series, they did know who Sam was. But I also find it interesting is, if you want to rationalize it away creatively, is that he's doing a little bit of mind merging with Dr. Bryant in this scene.
Yeah. Well, yeah, yet another potential example of something that occurs, I think, more later on, that the idea that when Sam leaps into someone, sometimes their memories and persona kind of imprint on him. Yeah.
And also, it's interesting to note, just for further plot development in this episode, we're also reminded that the 1972 presidential election is gearing up, because that's what's on TV right now, and Sam makes the point in his monologue that right now, with everything going on with Donna, he just doesn't find politics.
I thought that's interesting. When he leaps, that's one of the ways he roots himself, by, like, who's the president. He does that a couple times.
That's right.
And
yeah,
that's sort of how he remembers. I think maybe a way for him to put himself, because it's one thing to hear a time, but if you can say what was going on during that time, it kind of reminds you of where you were. And so he wants to figure out.
And he does that a lot in these early episodes, too, where not only does he, like, check in on who the president is, like, he kind of checks in, like, where he is at in his life.
I was just a baby.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, obviously the ways that he does that so frequently are through the television, through the newspapers, and through the radio.
Yeah.
You know, he'll hear something on
every time,
the TV.
Every time, Traveler's Device right there, everything right there, TV, radio, newspaper.
That's right. Yeah. Well, and so specifically, the TV report is on Edmund Muskie and George McGovern. There's also an update on Vietnam, which this is the first time that we get real mention of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. And to name check Muskie, which is interesting, you talked about in our preview episode, like, getting a real sense of history.
Yeah.
Another very Quantum Leap-esque show, Sliders.
Yeah.
Made reference to Muskie in one episode. Because all I know about Muskie is that he tainted for himself as a politician, is that he got so overcome during a debate, he started crying.
Yeah.
And that actually undermined him as a candidate.
Yeah.
And I just remember that from an episode of Sliders where one of the characters tries to do a very similar thing, and it ends up backfiring, and instead of... Because he's trying to undermine himself in this episode of Sliders by pulling a Muskie.
Yeah.
And it actually endears him with voters, and he ends up winning as a result. Anyway, side note.
No, hey, the more you know. The things you learn from television. And Vietnam is definitely something we'll hear more about. And something that I want to talk about real quick, which doesn't have to do specifically with this episode, but with the first season in general. Don Belisario, I think we talked about this last episode, actually, a little bit, had envisioned that this show would be geared towards a certain audience. And the audience he had in mind were baby boomers. Mm-hmm. And for baby boomers in particular, I think the mention of the 1972 election, and what's happening in politics in that particular year in general, and Vietnam would have been huge markers in their lives. And I think that the other thing that's interesting, just knowing my dad in particular, who is a baby boomer, where he would have been in his life in this particular time and era, is a time when I think you start paying a little bit more attention when you're in your, like, early to mid 20s, and to be surrounded by Vietnam and, you know, what's happening in the late 60s and early 70s politically and socially in this country. So I think that you know, that that's something
absolutely.
That
I mean, it's very much like if a time travel series that was on the air today, mm-hmm. if it name checked the 2000 presidential election between Bush and Gore and 9/11,
yeah, exactly,
very similar minds,
right? And so yeah, so that's an interesting device. Going to further that, the intro to the episodes now are, you know, they flash by certain years and there are certain images. The years that they flash by, even though we know Sam can travel in his own lifetime, are restricted to the 50s, 60s, and 70s. We don't get anything from the 80s. It's all these sort of times that a lot of baby boomers would look back on and feel young and excited and optimistic about, or pivotal moments that
sure.
changed the course of everything. You know, a lot of people today, when we look back on those years, historians talk about how the 70s was sort of the death of the dream, and that's when a lot of the baby boomers started to sell out, and the 80s were all about materialism, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But there was that time in the 50s and 60s and early 70s when there was still just a little bit of that passion, a little bit of that youth, that vitality. And so I think that the images that are also shown are these very famous images of, you know, the Kennedys and other
mm-hmm.
things that are happening at that time that, you know, baby boomers would have found easily identifiable. The fascinating thing about that is those weren't the people that ended up watching the show.
No, yeah.
So his target audience, he kind of failed with.
And that's the thing that that it's noted that he, Don Bellisario, layman at the 20-year anniversary of the 2009 Quantum Leap Convention, is that the show caught on with everybody else except for the baby boomers.
Yeah.
And the reason why, that's a discussion.
Right.
A discussion for another thing.
So
we're in this scene. He's smoking a pipe, and Jamie Lee shows up, and, like, she is in, like, full, like, Elizabethan. We won't edit that out later. Anyway.
Shows up in Elizabethan garb.
Yeah, and Al shows up at about the same time, and Sam's like, why are you here now? And Al's like, well, I think you did this on yourself, because the moon has crested over the towers of Camelot.
Yes.
And so, she's ready to go. She's ready.
She's Guinevere.
Yeah, she's
yes.
Guinevere. That's
yeah.
it. She is ready to go. And we have this nice little comedic moment where Al walks into Dr.
Closet.
Bryant's closet.
Yeah.
Like, there's kinky stuff. There's rubber stuff.
Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it's another, I think that it's another thing that Al gets to have some of these moments because of the nature of being a hologram and... because of his personality that helped to bring out the humor in a way that when there's other people in the room with Sam,
mm-hmm.
that Sam can't necessarily have the reaction that he wants to. Sometimes he does anyway, which creates for even further humorous moments.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Al gets to find out something that Sam isn't even aware about yet.
For sure.
And, yeah.
I feel like in this scene, Sam had a lot of asides to Al, and Jamie Lee just doesn't notice because Jamie Lee is wrapped up in her own.
Oh, yeah. I completely agree.
She probably just passed it off as part of the game.
As part of the
I don't
game,
get
yeah.
it, but whatever.
Yeah, so he shoos her away again, and then we cut to the next scene, where Sam is walking into the science building.
Oh, you know what? Let me go back real quick, because one thing that
absolutely.
We did forget to mention that I think is very important to this episode that does get established earlier is that Al is in danger of being removed from the project by
if
the committee.
If he gives any personal information.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's very important to this scene.
Yeah.
Because there's a whole discussion like, Donna knew how I like my cheeseburger.
Mm-hmm.
Which, when you say that out loud, that just sounds so damn... Yeah.
Yeah.
And so,
he's
yeah.
being a little naive there, Sam. You know?
And
but
so,
he's
yeah.
buying into fate
yes.
being a part of this.
Yes.
And I think that that's also an interesting exploration on another level of what is causing him to leap around.
Absolutely. And so this in the scene where Sam has made the huge connection that the reason why Donna left him at the altar is because her dad left her as a child, and so she can't establish a meaningful relationship with a man. First off, that's very convenient of his Swiss cheese memory
to
pull that up.
Yeah.
And secondly, like, he is all ready to jump into, well, let's reunite Donna with her dad. And that's when he starts going out for information. And that's when Al says, like, you know, like, they will pull me from the project. I've
yeah.
already done it once. I give you your last name. They'll pull me from the project. If I do it again, I can't.
And one of the things that, again, that does in, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, I think it establishes a really nice tension between these two plots
mm-hmm.
that doesn't interfere. In fact, if anything, helps to inform the main plot of the episode,
mm-hmm.
which reinforces whether some of the dialogue is as tight as it could be or nice as it could be. The overall plot of the episode, I think, continues to really flow nicely and feel like there's nothing distracting us from anything that's occurring. You know, like, we've got these little subplots, sure, with, like, Oscar and Jamie Lee, but overall, the overarching plot, everything fits together really, really well, but also not in some sort of, well, that's convenient sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's the storytelling aside from dialogue or direction, the storytelling is really, really kind of dialed in. And and it's one of the reasons why I think the episode holds up.
Mm-hmm.
So,
for sure.
Yeah. So anyway, yes.
So we're going to head down to the next scene of Sam showing up at the science building to talk with Don, and he has this nice little monologue where he romanticizes, oh, Bunsen burners are the common denominator between all the sciences, blah, blah, blah. And here I am stuck in Mr. English Lit. And then he goes in and he walks in on Donna working, and he walks up and he finishes an equation that she had wrong, or she was missing an essential piece from. And he explains to her why. And so we have this scene where they talk about, like, if you could go back in time, where would you go? And they kind of nerd out about this.
Hubble's constant.
That is it, yeah. And then Sam makes the mistake of, like, if you go back in time, what would you do? Would you go back before your dad left you?
Yeah. And so, of course, she's like, how do you know that?
And then Sam stumbles his way through an explanation, and he would like
you didn't
to,
list your father on your school records.
And yeah, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, so she's walking out. It's like, hey, I have this string theory on time travel. It's very speculative. I can't prove it, but I would love your thoughts on it. And what I find really interesting about this scene is, like, she doesn't say yes. She doesn't say no. He just throws it out there, and she walks away.
Yeah.
And then we cut to the montage, which I mentioned earlier, I call Sam mansplains quantum physics to the quantum physics student.
Yeah. Which, you know, on one hand, I mean, clearly with his Swiss cheese memory, you have to wonder, how does he remember all of these pieces? You know, on the other hand, he is this brilliant, brilliant man. I mean, that's the thing that sometimes I think... Sometimes it's very easy to remember this because he gets placed in situations where he gets to show it off. Other times, you're left kind of saying, you know, he's Einstein, and I forget that he's supposed to be Einstein. Mm-hmm. But it's not only that he's Einstein, you know, I mean, here's a guy who, you know, as we'll find out later on in the series, there's a lot more to him, you know. There's an artistic side, there's a lot of different sides to Sam Beckett. And so, you know, he is this brilliant man. He is in the teacher's clothes right now, if you will. Mm-hmm. So I think that, while yes, he's definitely, you know, mansplaining quantum physics to the quantum physics student, that it's understandable in so much as what he's attempting to do here with Donna and the knowledge that he possesses,
mm-hmm.
At that particular time.
For sure. And I guess we're going back to your saying, like, you don't see Donna as someone he would fall in love with. Like, rewatching this montage, like, in every single scene, he is explaining something to her.
Yeah.
And she's clearly like, wow, wow.
Mm-hmm.
And it could have benefited from, like, if there were, like, a scene or two in this montage where actually she's schooling him on something.
If it was a dialogue.
And we clearly see him going, like...
Well, because he just learned all that from Al. He didn't know that.
It's I didn't think any about that. Like, there wasn't a back and forth in that. It was like Sam explains everything, and that's not Terry Hatcher's fault.
Right.
That's the fault of the writing and the direction.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think that it feels like something that, you know, we've seen before many times where you have a male character, and in particular a younger female character,
mm-hmm.
Not always, but in particular a younger female character where, yeah, there's, you know, the man explains it all and that's that.
Mm-hmm.
Does his Swiss cheese memory, is it more like sort of amnesia? Like, he can't remember his stuff from the past, but anything moving forward, he retains? Is it that kind of a thing? Or is it that he's going to forget some of these leaps? And
It's very much implied that he has a very fuzzy memory.
In general.
Of
so it's still
leaps.
Continuing mm-hmm. to...
Basically, the way that I see it is that every time he leaps, it's sort of like, you know, you have this piece of Swiss cheese... Mid-leap, the cheese is filled again, and then he finishes the leap, and now there's new holes. So in other words, you imagine the full brain, and then all of a sudden there's new holes, and then the next leap happens, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, full brain, now new holes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, like, I think that there are certain things that he'll remember from time to time that he doesn't remember in a previous leap or the next leap, and that he won't necessarily remember the previous leap to the next,
mm-hmm.
yeah, etc. So yeah, I think that it's something that kind of resets every time, but there's always gaps.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So we fall onto the other end of the scene, and so at the end of the montage, we very conveniently have Terry Hatcher say, "But only in his own lifetime."
Right, right.
Yeah. Which kind of hints at, like, the future Saga Cell, which is very famous for, like, theorizing that we'll get time travel.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. But anyway, so they're sitting back in the Rathskeller. She has to go get ready for work, and this is very convenient for Al to show up in a very weird
outfit.
Piece of garb, like some outfit which includes some hieroglyphics hanging from his belt.
Yes.
And go ahead.
The you know, one of the things about this particular scene is that it really ties back into that ongoing conflict and tension that Al introduced early in the episode, that there is the danger of him getting removed. They can't share personal mm-hmm. information that...
So really, there's like Doctor Who, where if you do certain things, like, it could mess up the world and, you know, paradoxes or whatever. And in this case, it just feels like it's an arbitrary rule that this committee has come up with. And because it's the law, because it's the rule, you just have to do it. Like, if he learns this stuff, like, it's not gonna cause things to explode, is the sense I'm getting. Because it doesn't feel like Al has any real reservations about sharing the information. He just is like, I know I'm going
to
get in trouble.
And this is jumping back, and this is a comment that I forgot to make earlier, is that in the brief scene where we first, where we're down at the Rathskeller, and Al sees Donna for the first time, he has this line where he says, oh my God, it is her.
Mm.
And you just get this real sense he does not like Donna. And I'm sure a lot of it has to do with what Donna
did to Sam.
Mm-hmm. But just speaking on that, it's like, I don't think Al is necessarily thrilled about even trying to reunite
mm-hmm.
these two.
Well, he does. It seems like he thinks it's a bad idea.
Well, I think that the other thing is, though, that he identifies that Sam is clearly a very headstrong person. I mean, here's a guy who jumped into the Quantum Leap Accelerator before it was ready to go.
Sure.
So I suppose here that Al is thinking, he's going to do it anyway, I might as well do what I can.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, as we learn explicitly in this scene, he is very much at risk here.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens after he shows up is that he lets Sam in through pantomime, basically, that he's not alone,
mm-hmm.
that there are other people in the imaging chamber with him,
mm-hmm.
that Sam cannot see them, that they cannot hear Sam, but they can hear Al.
Mm-hmm. So we get this, and this is the first time it's clearly established that the imaging chamber just doesn't work for everyone.
Right.
Like, this project clearly centers around Sam and Al, and even though these people are standing in the imaging chamber with Al, like, they just see the walls of the room, basically,
yes.
And Al and Sam are the only ones who have that.
Right.
Connection.
Yeah, which kind of reinforces what we were talking about last episode about the nature of their relationship, which is something that I think will get further reinforced in the next couple of episodes that we
mm-hmm.
talk about.
Well, there's even a line later on in this episode, I think, that further reinforces it, but we'll...
Yeah, we'll get there.
So through these hieroglyphics, first off, Sam realizes that one of his 6 degrees is not in psychology, as Al points out, because Sam is trying to explain, like, her dad left her, and that's why, and if I could just reunite. And I was like, you know, those 6 degrees you hold, not one of them in psychology. Quantum physics, yes. Medicine, yes. Ancient languages, yes. And not so subtly pointing down at the sash. And then Sam starts like, I can't read any of that. And all of a sudden, like, he can identify the symbols for...
Capital and army.
For capital, Pharaoh's army. And then we have, like this little song and dance, who's on first routine. And finally, he figures out that Donna's dad is in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And it's at this point where Al, you know, basically the jig is up. Like, people on the other side can tell what's going on. And Al's like, what hieroglyphics?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, the sash gets pulled away, and we see these invisible arms
hook Al and dragging
him out of the imaging chamber. And it's interesting, this one, because the imaging chamber door is usually just presented as like a door-sized door.
Yeah.
But if you really pay attention in the background, like, it's almost like these huge garage doors that open up.
Yeah.
And
Al
shutter
yeah.
and Al.
But as he's being dragged out, he does have time to...
Her dad's name.
How
right?
did I say
name.
Colonel Wojciechowicz in
yeah.
hieroglyphics?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now Sam has a place, a occupation, and a last name.
Mm-hmm.
And
Donna comes back in.
Yep.
And now he's like, can we go, you know, do you want to travel with me to Washington, D.C. to
yeah.
reunite a lost love?
Right.
And I can't remember if she agrees to it, but it's just kind of left up in the air.
She pretty much
kind of, yeah.
She yeah, she, at this point, you know, again, at this point, I think that, and it gets a little more weird in the trip to DC, but at this point, you're starting to see that Donna is seeing Dr. Bryant in a different light.
Mm-hmm.
And even more than a teacher-student sort of light.
Mm-hmm.
Respectful, you know, okay, maybe he's not as awful as I thought, he's a good teacher sort
sure.
of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and it's funny because at this particular point, well, before that, I guess, actually, he goes back and makes the phone call to her dad.
Mm-hmm.
And talks to her dad.
Well, no, it's after this point, yeah, we have the scene where he talks to the dad and basically, like, he tries to play the psychologist thing, like, all over, like, you know, you leaving her, blah, blah, blah. She can't love another man. You two need to reunite. We find out that Colonel Moore Jehoiach is shipping out for Vietnam.
Yeah.
The very next day, and he doesn't want to reopen these old wounds. Moore Jehoiach hangs up on him. We get a knock at the door, and
it's Oscar.
Oscar returns. We get, like, a punch. We don't know who it is. Like, we just see Sam get punched to the ground. We go to commercial break, and then we come back.
It's, yeah.
Yeah. And so we find out that Oscar's overtures towards Jamie Lee hasn't worked. Because something like, you know, I said that her perfume made me horny. And
yeah.
This made me even hornier. And Sam's like, no, you're still like... And this is where he says, like, horny is not romantic to a thing. And then we find out Oscar's real contribution to the story is that Oscar has a car.
Mm-hmm.
to get them
which
to DC.
Is also very funny because one of the things that Sam does to convince Donna to go to Washington is promises that there will be a chaperone.
That's right, yes.
And it's hilarious to me that the chaperones end up being Jamie Lee and Oscar.
Oscar, yeah. And I love the line in the scene where it's like, how do you feel about you, me, Donna and Lisi, Jamie Lee, and you going to DC together? And Oscar's like, in that order?
Yeah.
And Sam's like, yes. In that order.
Yeah. Like, what?
Yeah. And then we cut to them driving in the middle of the night, some nice little 70s music playing.
Yeah.
Headed towards DC. And this is the point when I was rewatching the episode, Betsy was kind of in and out of the room. So she was kind of like half following the episode, but she didn't really follow the plot. And so she walked through it, sat down at this point, and I was like, all right, so let's say you're estranged from one of your parents, and the somewhat kind of creepy guy in your life drops on you at almost the last moment, like the point of no return, that he is taking you to reunite with that parent. What would you do? And Betsy was like, I would remove myself from that situation as soon as possible.
Yeah.
So it's in this scene where Sam reveals what he's doing. Like, at first, Donna thinks that they're making this cross-country drive just to put Jamie Lee and Oscar together, but then he reveals, like, no, I'm driving you to Washington,
I almost thought...
Well, before...
To meet your father.
But before that happens, though, real quick, because I do think this is important, Al reappears to Sam.
Not yet.
No, yeah, it is. It's before this. It's before, because they stop at a gas station.
Mm-hmm.
And when they stop at the gas station, Al reappears, and Sam
That's
is super
right.
happy.
Yes.
He's like, I never thought I'd see you again.
Good point.
Al tells him about setting Tina up with Weitzman
mm-hmm.
to get dirt on him so that he can basically bribe him.
Yeah. You set up with Tina with Weitzman and then blackmailed him. Yes.
Yes.
And this is the really telling moment that I shared before, too. It's like, they don't, like, bang you over the head with it. But when Al throws out the idea that, hey, if you reunite Donna with her dad, there's a good chance she'll be able to commit to a relationship with the future. And Sam says, no offense, this time I'm going to make Ziggy my best man. Which implies that the first time, Alice
was
the
best man.
Mm-hmm. And so you kind of get an idea. Because at this point, you don't really know what they're... If they have a relationship other than a work relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And
I mean,
so now you get the idea that Sam and Al are truly best friends.
Right. And again, I would argue that just because of what we learned in the first episode, and this could be a lot of hindsight informing this, that the whole they're connected by their neurons and mesons, that's like a big deal as well. But
mm-hmm.
yeah, this is definitely affirming that in a way that we didn't get in the pilot. Another thing that's interesting, though, that happens here that's kind of a bit of a bombshell, if you ask me, is that Sam's going to all these lengths to try to get Donna back with her father so that, you know, eventually she'll marry him, is that we find out by Al telling Sam that Donna was engaged once before Sam.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, kind of throwing the issue up in the air of, even if this works, she might not marry you. What if she stays with the first guy, sort of thing?
Mm-hmm.
Which then brings us to the moment in the car where Donna says, why are you taking me to Washington, D.C.?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there was also a cute little moment earlier with Jamie Lee and Donna over Oscar pretends to shoot a deer that they see.
Oh.
In this whole thing. Like, you would shoot a deer. I want, you know. Basically, he's touching me.
Yeah.
Get him away from me.
Right, right, right. Because she's like, Bambi was a deer, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, Sam and Donna kind of team up to kind of bring Jamie Lee around to Oscar's point.
Right, because is it something about what Lancelot does for Guinevere?
Lancelot
like
brought Guinevere at least a deer a week.
Yeah, 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 something like that, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so we have this moment where Sam reveals, like, this is why they're driving to D.C. to reunite.
Yeah, and then, you know, and then Sam ends up telling her during that moment that he had a fiancé leave him at the altar, as in Dr. Bryant, not Sam Beckett, and that's one of the reasons why
she was into quantum physics. That's why he reads the books.
Yeah, and so he's trying to reunite her with her father so that, you know, the same thing doesn't happen to her one day, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah. And then after she reveals, like, there's a shot of Donna looking out the window and she says, you really are romantic.
Yeah.
Then we have the 70s music, and then we go into the building where Dr. Wojciechowicz is staying. They go into the lobby. They try to get in. They can't get in because they can't prove that Donna is
because she has a different
his
last
daughter,
name.
Different yeah. last name. And rewatching this episode, it's like it's an hour of television and it's mostly a comedy, whatever. But Donna is just really nonchalant at this point about going to meet her estranged dad.
Yeah.
That
she's kind of going along with it
that
all.
That left 12 years ago. It was like, oh, yeah, she's not nervous at all. She's ready to go. But they get shooed out of the lobby by the security guards. They find another way to get into the building because it turns out there's a door that's been broken
left
into.
Ajar.
Yeah, left ajar. And actually, like, the lock has been broken.
The lock's been taped over.
Yeah, and yeah. taped over. And then the security guards go out. They check Sam's story. Like, hey, we drove all the way from Ohio. The security guard, yep, sure enough, there's a car in the parking lot with Ohio plates. And then we get this nice little beat you over the head moment where the security guard goes. He finds the same unlocked door that Sam and Donna had just found. And it turns out we're at the Watergate Hotel.
Yes. Our kiss with history.
Our kiss with history.
This is Watergate
yeah, this
hotel,
is the
yeah.
night of the Watergate break-in.
I didn't realize they were at a hotel. So when that happened, I was so confused because I was like, you were like, it's Watergate. I'm like, what? They're at like an office or like a... It's some sort of military Pentagon or something.
It was confusing. And I remember, like, first watching this episode when I was a kid. Like, I wasn't aware exactly what Watergate was other than it was a huge political scandal. And so when I remember seeing this episode when I first viewed it as a kid, I thought that they were saying that somehow Sam had accidentally caused
the scandal
that
too for a second.
By breaking in.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think I had the same thought. I understood sort of in an abstract of what Watergate was, but I thought that, oh, Sam accidentally did this and that's it left the door open so that the robbers could come in. But in reality,
or the people playing it, yeah.
Now we know that the door was already left open because they were
and
probably already in
there,
and then yeah.
yeah.
Which, you know, hey, at this particular point in time, just imagine while Sam and Donna are up there getting ready to visit her father, Forrest Gump is across the street complaining because the lights have been left on.
that is amazing. Yes. Yes.
All the connections.
Yeah. So now we find ourselves standing in front of Wojciechowicz's door.
Yes.
Kind of sets up. She's standing in front, opens the door. Donna starts crying. This was a mistake. And he's like, no, the mistake was waiting 12 years. And
yeah. Which I gotta say is unfortunate in a way because it is a really cheesy line.
Mm-hmm.
That's like what he says. Like, you know, it's.
But still, I mean, we're towards the end of the episode.
Yeah.
We gotta
yeah.
wrap this up. And so Sam starts to leave somewhat forlornly and she runs off. And then they have this line of like, if only if I was a little bit younger, you were a little bit older, like this cheesy romantic line. I think he kisses her on the nose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he tells her that one day she will be older.
Yes.
You know, and then he leaves and, you know, he's all excited and
yeah. But before we get that, let's talk about what kind of a bastard move is it to reunite Donna with her dad the night before he ships out to Vietnam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it definitely goes back to what we were saying early at the very beginning of the episode about Sam's selfishness.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he is being very selfish. It's understandable if you start thinking about it in this wide sort of ranging psychological way where he's out there traveling through time, setting right what once went wrong, and that, you know, this is a reward. But at the same time, it's kind of like, well, you had your reward last time when you got to call your dad. And this does feel very, very single-minded, very one-track mind. But I think that it does kind of help to, and again, I don't know that we necessarily see Sam do anything quite this selfish again. Spoilers. There are times where he comes close, certainly, but I would argue that maybe this softens a little bit as the show goes on. So again, it might play into what you were saying about not knowing who Sam was yet, the writers not knowing as much. But he is clearly, when he gets something in his mind that he's got to do, he just goes for it. And I think with his intelligence that there's probably a certain expectation of being right. You know, like, this is the I feel this is the right thing to do. I'm gonna do it. You know, I'm gonna step into the quantum loop accelerator. I'm going to try to reunite myself with my lost love in the future by fixing her up with her dad. And damn everything else.
So before we go to the home stretch, I think it's interesting to note that from a production standpoint, the producers went out of their way to find the actor who played Colonel Wojciechowicz. They found someone who reasonably could look like Donna's father. So someone who looked very similar to Terry, similar enough to Terry Hatcher.
Yes.
But also someone who was somewhat similar to Scott Bakula.
Oh, interesting.
So that the idea was, like, Terry Hatcher, Donna, saw a little bit of her dad in Scott Bakula. Which brings up daddy issues in a whole other weird little way.
Well, and I think that we should mention the actor that plays the father is Michael Gregory, who is somebody that I think is recognizable, in particular in the sci-fi genre, because he's, you know, he's in a couple of other, you know, big films like Total Recall and RoboCop, and, you know, he plays a couple of roles in other things. I think RoboCop, he's probably a little bit more recognizable.
I've never seen RoboCop all the way through.
Oh, okay, all right.
Total Recall. You know, it's been a while.
I think RoboCop is worth it, and maybe, I don't know.
Yeah. But so anyway, so we head into the home stretch of Sam in the stairwell, like doing like a little like celebration, dancing around, and Al reveals to him that, you know, it's at this point I think we're at June 17th, if I'm correct, June 17th, 1972, Watergate, and we have this little comedic moment of Sam's like, I don't remember, and Al's line of,
oh yeah, my, here's my Al line of the episode,
yeah,
the Republicans would love you.
Yes. And so Al reminds him that she may end up marrying this other guy first.
Yeah.
And Sam's like, no, I'm confident. Like, I got connections.
Yeah.
Really kind of confident.
And he points upstairs, and it's interesting because it reinforces something that I think the next episode, which we will...
You have feelings
talk more about. And I do have feelings
next
about,
week.
Yeah. It reinforces this idea that even though they keep saying things like God, time, fate, or whatever, although that's not been really said a lot, it's something that...
It was some kind of a tagline. Saying God or time or fate or whatever has...
And it eventually becomes a bit of a tagline of the show, but at this point, there seems to be this sort of this reinforcement that whatever it is, it's the man upstairs, if you will, you know? And so, yeah, he's, I got connections. Then the other thing is, though, that is interesting about this, that I think is worth discussing briefly, is that he's done all this stuff with Donna. He's not yet leaped.
Yep.
And what ends up actually causing the leap is when Jamie Lee and
Oscar
kiss.
Upstairs, they finally connect. The kiss. Yes.
And now Sam leaps. And I think that I will talk about this real briefly, and we'll talk about it more next episode, that he leaps into a boxing ring in the middle of a fight, and he gets punched right in the face. And I don't know that this was intentional, but it's the way my brain is going to read it. I think it's God, time, or fate's way of saying, like, you just messed with the plan, and I need you to wake up.
That's interesting.
You know, the idea that, like, you're doing things that you shouldn't be doing, or that I'm not ready for you to do, that you're not as smart as you think you are, so here's a bit of a wake-up call. Probably not. Probably just completely arbitrary, especially knowing the way that the episodes were actually shot, whatever. But, yeah, so that's his next leap. He's in the middle of a boxing ring, and he gets hit in the face.
That's interesting. To jump back on one thing to kind of wrap up, like, the scene that we keep coming back to, a little bit of of misogyny and overpossessiveness on males on account of a woman. It's interesting that what, and I didn't think about this until just now in this moment, that what locks in Oscar's and Jamie Lee's relationship is what is supposedly their first kiss. And I remember, like, when I was in my late teens in college, like, kind of being confronted with this idea by a girl that I was interested in, is, like, men have this idea in their heads that if I kiss it, it is mine.
Well.
And that, like, it's not like, you know, like, we know that they're going to get together because of this, because they found some kind of common ground. God, time or fate or whatever, doesn't leap Sam out until they have their first kiss. And that kind of locks in that they are going to be together.
I don't remember the moment well enough, to be honest with you, even though I just watched it less than a week ago. If it's like a mutual kiss, or is it him kissing her?
No. It is a mutual, like, she is, like, head on her chest. And it's a really sweet moment where they look up and make eye contact.
Yeah.
It is a very consensual thing. Like, they come in together.
Yeah.
But it's still, it's a thing of, it's the kiss that locks in the relationship. Like, oh, they're going to work out now.
Yeah. You know, and I think that there's something to be said for just the conventions of drama in general.
Absolutely.
And the idea that we, you know, sometimes we can't give you the full story.
Sure.
You know, again, it's like the famous, you know, there's the picture of a pipe. And you ask the students, what is this? It's a pipe. No, it's a picture of a pipe. And, you know, with the idea being that it's the same, like, this is something that they teach film students, like, on day one, basically. It's that's what film is. Mm-hmm. Film is not the actual thing. It's a picture of the thing. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it has to be representative. And so in this instance, you know, yeah, the convention is like a kiss is the representative of these two people getting together, you know, and that everything's going to work out in the end.
Absolutely.
Which is interesting because, digression for a moment. Jessica and I watched Dirty Dancing last night, and it's, you know, one of her favorite films. And as we're watching Dirty Dancing, she says this thing to me about how Baby and Johnny don't end up together. And I'm just like, what are you talking about? They don't end up together. And she's like, well, it's a summer thing. It's, you know, they're together and this thing happens and it's important to both of them. But then that's that.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to be honest, like, for me, the way that my brain, I guess, was conditioned when I was younger and came across this film in particular, it's just sort of like, oh, the film ends. They're together. Like, that's that. They're making babies in 5 years.
He drives off and leaves her there. I mean, not like leaves her, but he goes on to his next thing. It's clear that they're not together.
but I would argue it's not. It's not clear. And that's okay, because it's nice that we get to make up our own stories, which brings me something about I want to say about this episode, about the cliffhanger nature of him leaping out. Because, and it plays into what you're talking about with Jamie Lee and Oscar, we don't know what happens with them necessarily. Specifically what I'm talking about, we don't know what happens with Donna. We don't know what happens with Donna.
I found that to be disgruntling as we moved forward. I mean, I think because the nature of the shows are very self-contained and you can kind of just keep going, you can pop in and out, but I did find myself, like, wanting to know what did happen and getting kind of the sense that maybe I wasn't going to find out at all, or not for a very long time, and, like, it wouldn't be something that would, like, linger with him necessarily. Like, he doesn't even seem to be thinking anymore about what happened. Maybe that plays a part of the whole Swiss cheese thing. Maybe he's kind of forgotten he did that, but yeah, I don't know. That was a little disappointing to not get, like, even Al, like, saying something about what happened. Or, I mean, I'm not surprised, I guess, because, like, I imagine there will be an episode about it in the future, but.
Well, and without spoiling anything specific, one thing that I will bring up that just popped into my head is that as the series progresses, and I don't feel like this is any sort of big spoiler, so I'm just going to mention it. Oftentimes, at the end of episodes, Al will actually tell Sam what happens after he leaps out. So, in other words, when Sam gets ready to do the thing, or he's done the thing and he's waiting to leap, Al's looking at the handset and saying, like, oh, blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah happens, and they have three kids together and live happily ever after, and it puts that sort of button on the episode.
We get wrapped up.
But at this point in the series, we don't get that.
And we'll talk about this more in the next two episodes. I really think at this early point in the series, they really didn't know what to do with Al.
Oh. Oh, yes. Next episode, we will definitely talk about this.
Yes.
So, anyway, wrapping up Star-Crossed, I think what I will say in closing is that, for me, the episode, it holds up. And one of the things that I will remark upon for this block of episodes coming up, and I'll go ahead and say it now, is that I was surprised with the pacing. The episodes feel to me paced in a very... quick way. They like, honestly, I don't know how it is for everyone else, but for me, they've kind of flown by. And the pilot doesn't. The pilot dawdles a little bit. And I'm not going to say whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I don't know that I'll ever make up my mind about that. But this episode and the next few episodes, for me, as I was watching them, they really kind of fly by. Mm-hmm. You know, the scenes come and they're kind of short, and then you get the next scene and on and on and on and on. And so I for me, that's something that I've been enjoying about it. It's weird coming back to it after a time, because I don't know whether I would say, as we're closing up this episode, that it still holds the same place in my heart and memory as it did before I rewatched it, which is tough for me in a way, because I think that there was something about the romantic aspect of the episode and me identifying with Sam so much that I just saw this as like, oh yeah, he's got to do it. He's got to make way for this to happen in the future. And oh, it really tugs at my heartstrings. And I, you know, and I get where he's coming from and I understand it. And now I watch it and there's something about it that, as I'm watching it, it feels, and not because of the nature of doing it for a podcast, but I felt a little more distance. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel quite as involved emotionally as I had been when I was younger. Mm-hmm. I still enjoyed it. It was hard for me, though, to completely be on board with everything Sam was doing.
Yes, I would agree with that. That's my biggest problem with the episode, is being a much more informed adult as I was when I was younger. All the issues that we talked about of just not respecting a woman's wishes. Those were certainly issues, obviously, for me, which we talked about. It has a high watchability factor with me. Very simply, Terry Hatcher is a very attractive woman.
She is. She is, and she is very, yes, without a doubt. Without a doubt. There's a comment that gets made, actually, in Beyond the Mirror Image. Let's see here.
This was like one of the first times in the filming of the episodes where Dean Stockwell was out of his trailer more often than what he needed to be,
and
specifically just to be around Terry Hatcher. And it's interesting for a long time, because this was my introduction to Terry Hatcher in anything when I was a kid, and for a long time I thought of her as the actress that was Nana, and I think now looking back, I would identify her most with her character from Desperate Housewives.
Yeah.
Which I will admit, I was really into for the first couple of seasons. If you've never seen it, Desperate Housewives, just the first season, is a very nice, self-contained story.
Yeah.
Like at the start of the season, they tell you exactly what the story is going to be about. At the end of the season, they wrap up that story. And if all you ever watch is that one season, it's a very self-contained story.
I agree with that, first of all, because I think that the interesting thing about that first season, when I was in college when it came on, and it was paired with something else, and now I'm blanking on it. There was something that was on before it.
I don't remember.
It wasn't Lost.
I feel like it was paired up with Grey's Anatomy for a while. Boston Legal for a while.
Yeah, Boston Legal and then Grey's Anatomy. You're right. Yeah. And I watched both of those shows. I love Boston Legal, actually. But anyway, the first season, one of the things that I think it does really well, though, is that it explores these characters and these women, and it makes kind of a social commentary that as the show went on, it became more and more outrageous and soap operatic. Mm-hmm. And as it did that, I certainly lost a connection to it, and I didn't watch it religiously by any means, but I certainly caught enough of the first season to know what you're talking about. Yeah, she, you know, she had an interesting career, and I think that out of, you know, everyone that we've seen, we're only two episodes in, but she's certainly the biggest star, if you will, so far, and I would argue probably even within the first season, of all the guest stars that we get.
I don't think she had done anything of note then, but as far as like actors who go on to do other things.
She had an extended run on Love Boat, actually, of all things. I only know that from IMDb.
I can sing you the theme song, but that's but that's about it.
But yeah, the next big thing really that she would do would be Lois and Clark. Mm-hmm. And which, you know, if you're a fan of Superman, I definitely suggest checking it out. I know your mileage will vary, especially as the series goes on. But that first season is pretty solid
for sure.
So Jessica, your summation of Star-Crossed?
Yeah, I didn't connect so much with the romance of the story, I don't think. I did like getting some tidbits about his personal life. I mean, I guess we get that with his dad, but yeah, I thought it didn't linger with me. Like, I kind of almost had a hard time remembering this episode as we were talking about it. I was like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. So,
because you've taken somewhat of a crash course in Quantum Leap in the last.
Yeah, I think I've now seen three more past this one.
Yes.
So there are others that stuck out to me more, not necessarily in a good way.
Yeah.
And this one felt just mediocre, I guess.
You said something interesting that I wrote down as we were watching the episode, actually. You asked me, wouldn't Donna remember the conversations that she was having? Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this kind of goes to stuff we've talked about before, but, you know, you would think that she would have remembered in the future her conversations with this weirdo guy in the one week when he was, like, kind of normal and romantic in the future. I guess I don't remember exactly what I was thinking about when I said that, but I think it goes back to, clearly in this show, stuff happened and now it's being changed.
Mm-hmm.
Versus this stuff he had gone back in the past. He had always gone back.
Yeah.
Things
I would say, and I've never really thought about this, but if you believe that some higher power is in charge of these leaps, and maybe that higher power is Swiss cheesing Sam's memory, that same higher power Swiss cheeses people's memory. So that they don't quite remember.
That's a little fuzzy.
So they don't quite remember these things. It's the same reason why Lorraine Bates McFly doesn't remember that weird week out of her life when Calvin Klein just totally overtook everything.
Sure. It's a Back to the Future reference.
I wasn't allowed to watch that. There's bad words.
Jess missed out on some movies when she was younger.
Little Rascals, we got banned from watching that one because they say butthead.
Yes, but why were you banned from watching it?
Because
specifically,
we kept calling each other butthead. Sorry, Mom,
and
for saying butthead so many times.
You didn't get to see Titanic until you
were... Oh, yeah, that I protested that one for a long time because I wasn't allowed to watch Titanic because of the bad language. And my sister got to watch it at an age that was younger than when I wasn't allowed to watch it. And I was at a Girl Scout sleepaway, and I made myself go into the other room because I knew I wasn't allowed to watch it. And I was a nerd, so...
I love you so much. I think in wrapping this one up, that there are a lot of what ifs that get left at the end of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're talking about with, you know, what if Donna remembered some of this stuff? What if she remembers sort of this man that Dr. Bryant was, and when she gets back to Lawrence, she's just sort of like, hey, Dr. Bryant,
that's what I thought,
like, palling
too.
Around. Like,
I thought maybe he was going to stick around and make Dr. Bryant be the first guy that she was engaged to, and then, like, break it off, so knowing then the next one would be him.
Oh.
And then, you know,
you're
again...
a real bastard.
Again, they do have that moment where, you know, she's like, oh, if I was a little older, and, you know, oh, if I was a little younger. You know, and they have that moment that... So I think they do establish well enough that they're not going... There's no danger of you know, Donna and Gerald Bryant getting together.
But also, now you just thought about it. Now the real Dr. Bryant has to drive back to Ohio with Donna.
Which I think that one of the things that we kind of theorized and has and, you know, has been posted before on many message boards and, you know, Reddits and such is that that when the person leaps back into their regular life, that they get a little bit, you know, in the same way that Sam sometimes gets a little bit of them, they get a little bit of Sam. So they kind of know a little bit about what's happening. Or Al's debriefing them maybe in the waiting room, you know, hey, just be aware that this is going to be changed or something like that.
Because you'd think the professor would come back and then try to sabotage, you know, his girlfriend.
Sure.
His previous girlfriend and her new boyfriend now. You'd think he would be trying to sabotage us on the ride back to Ohio because...
Right.
Last he knew, he was having kinky sex with this girl.
With Jamie Lee.
Yeah, so why wouldn't he want that to continue?
Yeah. Those what-ifs are interesting to
me.
For
sure.
It's the family nature.
I would say if you really want to delve deep into those kind of story elements with time travel, movie like The Butterfly Effect.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure.
Fantastic, because they really get into that.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I know Butterfly Effect gets made fun of a lot simply for the fact of Ashton Kutcher.
Right.
I will argue that that is a fantastic time travel movie.
Yeah.
Actually.
I saw it once when I was like 19, but so there you have it. There is Star-Crossed, which is the first episode proper of Quantum Leap.
Mm-hmm.
We're now technically in the first season. We're past the pilot. Interesting for the selection for that first episode, especially knowing that it wasn't the one shot to be the first episode.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll get to that one later. So in the meantime, we are out of here and on to the next leap, which will be the right hand of God. So join us next time for that one.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed what you've heard or have any questions or comments, don't be shy. Reach out to us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And remember to hit the subscribe button and leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may be listening. Until next time.
If I'm not there, our hearts may touch.